Good afternoon. Welcome to Division 6 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have two cases scheduled on our 1:30 docket this afternoon, Durham versus Davis and Waldman versus Schneider. I assume counsel for all of those two cases are all checked in, ready to go? Great. You should have all received a set of written instructions detailing our oral argument procedures. Let me just ask if any counsel have any questions about any of our procedures or that document? Wonderful. Okay. If not, what we're going to do is we'll proceed first to hear argument in the Durham case, and then we'll hear argument in the Waldman case. I'd advise, remind counsel, if you would please identify yourselves by name and attorney registration number when you come to the podium. And I'd ask if anybody in the courtroom has a cell phone or a pager or anything like that, please turn it off now so as not to interrupt counsel and the court during argument. And unless there are any questions, we are ready for argument in Durham versus Davis.
Afternoon, Your Honor. Afternoon. I represent Danger Durham, the plaintiff appellant in this case, and Mr. McConaty and I did the trial. So we're both here on the appeal, and I will speak up, Judge Rivera. You see that. The issues we have today are three, basically. We have a Reuter-SAM issue regarding notice. We have an issue involving Trattler, I guess we would call it, issue. And we also have an issue involving the trial judge not allowing certain rebuttal testimony that the plaintiff wanted to offer at trial. Those are our three issues. There's actually, in a way, a lot of material that I could cover with you. Given the number of issues and the development of them, I don't mind answering questions either, so I'm just going to kind of start out. I think the briefs lay it out, in this case, pretty well. So on the Trattler issue, and I should also say at the beginning that I went and shepherdized everything this morning, and I didn't find anything new beyond Erskine, really, on this Trattler issue, saying that Trattler applies retroactively. So I'm not aware of anything new. So I'm looking at the Trattler case on this issue, really. And what happened in this case is the defendant had one specially retained expert, Dr. Noonan. Dr. Noonan is an orthopedic surgeon. He does shoulder surgeries regularly. I submitted discovery asking about depositions, and there wasn't any disclosure of any prior depositions he'd given. I got to his deposition and found out he'd given 8. 6 of them, it turned out, involved shoulders. Now, this case involves a shoulder misdiagnosis of a shoulder infection and injection with Marcaine and Kenalog of an infected shoulder that suppressed the immune system and caused the shoulder to basically be eaten up by the infection. So in any treatment that Dr. Noonan did of shoulders in terms of how you diagnose, what you look at, is very, very important. I think it's kind of funny. Justice Ide was the dissent in Trattler, and I saw he was in Router. He wrote the opinion. So he's all over these issues. And he wrote in his dissent in Trattler something that was really, I thought, was spot on, because what he basically said was, the purposes of Rule 26 is to enable opposing counsel to obtain prior testimony of the expert that may be relevant to the proposed testimony in the pending case, and to enable a party to prepare for cross-examination at a deposition or trial. Dr. Noonan's prior testimony about what he considers when diagnosing shoulders would have been very critical in this case.
Counsel, let me ask a question. Sir. Prior to your moving to strike Noonan's testimony at trial,
yes.
Did you file a Rule 37 motion to compel or any other motion under Rule 37 prior to trial asking for relief or sanctions under that rule?
I did not. I advised opposing counsel that I would be addressing this if I didn't get the depositions on several occasions and was told they would not be coming. But I did not file a motion to compel.
What legal effect, if any, do you think there is by not filing that pretrial motion?
Well, it seems like the real issue, Your Honor, is whether the rule is self-executing as to Rule 26 and an expert's failure to provide what he is supposed to provide. I don't think a motion to compel is a prerequisite to having testimony stricken of an expert for failure to comply, or some other alternate sanction.
Did you ask for alternate sanctions?
At the time, I asked for the testimony to be stricken.
Thank you.
Yes.
Counsel, I understand that at the time of trial, Trattler had not yet been decided.
Yes.
But understanding under Erskine that it's to be applied retroactively, what options did the court have at that point as far as sanctions?
Well, actually, there were a number of them. I think the one that would have been most appropriate would be to instruct the jury that the doctor had given 6 prior shoulder depositions and that they had not been produced. So basically explain what happened.
But that wasn't asked for.
It wasn't asked for because at the time we didn't have Trattler, and so it wasn't that clear. And essentially at the time the law was, it starts with a C, what Carlson versus Ferris, it was essentially, it seemed very clear to everyone at the trial level that the testimony gets stricken if the rule is not complied with for a specially retained expert. So I guess you could say, maybe I would have known, but I didn't.
The briefs on appeal both extensively argue different sides of this issue about whether a specially retained expert who has given prior testimony as an expert but not as a specially retained expert has to produce a list of those depositions. That's what the briefs seem to argue.
Right.
Neither brief cites a lot of case law. Indeed, I'm not sure the brief cite any case law on that issue. Is there any Colorado authority or even non-Colorado authority on that issue?
All there is the rule. All there is the rule. I can't find any case authority on that issue. And now that you mention it, perhaps looking in other states might have been useful, and I think I actually did do that at one point. I couldn't find anything anywhere on this issue. So, I think you know my argument on it, that the rule says what it says, but I couldn't find any case authority to answer your question.
Thank you.
So, okay. But I think the last thing I have to say about that before moving on to the next issue, because your questions are spot on to what I would be asking. Under Trattler, what I see is sort of a two-level analysis. Was there bad faith? And here we have a refusal to provide these depositions. So that, if you have bad faith, I think you can have a self-executing striking of the testimony in its entirety. You don't get into this issue of what's disclosed or not disclosed. And I think we have that here, but if you don't, then you get to the alternate sanctions of what could the trial court do short of striking testimony.
If there's a legitimate disagreement about the requirements of the rule, though, would you call that bad faith?
Well, as you can probably tell, I don't think it's legitimate. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time at the trial level, and this is the first time I've ever heard that claim that, and I think the rule is plain as day, that a specially retained expert has to provide this deposition list. So I wouldn't characterize it as a legitimate dispute.
What if there were out-of-state cases to go the other way?
If there were out-of-state cases to go the other way, that I think Judge Boris's question is correct. I think that then there probably is a legitimate dispute, but none were ever brought to anybody's attention, and I'm not aware of any. So,
Mr. Taylor, it appears from Judge Loeb's questioning that an important element was the fact that your motion was not made until the course of trial.
Yes.
And that's so that in the course of trial, didn't that as a result of that alternative sanctions which could have been imposed by the trial court, such as rescheduling the case, rescheduling depositions or trial, or holding the expert in contempt?
Yes.
Were really not available. Whereas if it had been brought beforehand in preparation for trial, all of the facts could have been evaluated, and the facts could have been evaluated in different alternatives proposed.
I see what you're saying. And at the time, under the law that existed at the time, it seemed pretty clear what the sanction was. And the other thing is I think the record would show, as I showed the trial court that I asked opposing counsel, I pressed them continuously up to trial for them to provide me with those depositions. So it was kind of a ball in motion up to the end. Yep. I'm going to move to the rotor issue for a second. Jumping to the nub of this, the Sams case says six times notice should be given. Defense counsel's argument in this case is, well, we think that ultimately there was no residually privileged information, so ultimately we were going to get an ex parte interview, so why give a notice? Well, it's sort of like a statute of limitations. There's broader reasons for that drop-dead requirement that impact litigation as a whole. Is one problem. Another is HIPAA requires notice, and HIPAA is more restrictive than state law on this issue, so certainly there's no civil remedy under HIPAA, but that's another reason. And a third reason is, as in the Sams case, if I had been given notice, I would have said to the trial court, I want an order, like in the Sams case, that says, okay, here's the information, here are the limitations on what will be discussed with this physician. I don't know what of the other information that's potentially out there was provided. I would like, for instance, these days, so much the information is electronic, I would like an order that during these meetings, no hospital records that contain broad information about this patient would be accessed or discussed with this physician. So I was deprived of all of those things. I don't think you can say, I don't think the court wants to establish a precedent that no notice is required and it's up to defense counsel whether that's the case or not in a particular case.
What's the standard of review for our analysis of this issue?
Abuse of discretion, manifestly arbitrary or unfair, I believe. So that's one problem. And then sort of going to the collaborative unitary treatment issue that's in the Roeder decision, this case is sort of a midway. In Roeder, it was a cardiac emergency, and all of the physicians were in the emergency room trying to save the patient. Pretty clear case. And then in Sams, you've got 20 different doctors over the course of a month or so seeing the patient, which is almost another extreme. Here, the argument made by the defense has been that Dr. Davis and Dr. Cernkovich, the radiologist, collaborated, and really they didn't. Dr. Davis saw the patient in his office. He ordered an MRI. Ms. Durham went and got an MRI done, and Dr. Cernkovich wrote a report, and all that ever happened was Dr. Davis saw the report. They never talked. They never collaborated. About 5 days passed during which this was happening. So Roeder talks about communicating and collaborating, and so I think there's a reasonable argument to be made that if I'd been given notice, I would have had a chance to make that argument and say that, you know, potentially this wasn't a unitary course of treatment here. But again, without notice, that's hard to do. I just think that the SAMS notice requirement due to HIPAA and SAMS and has to be absolute. It can't. And I think that what happens is if you don't do that, you open the door to a Pandora's box. You know all the facts about how many times opposing counsel met with Dr. Cernkovich here, so I'm not even going to go into that, but there were four meetings, hour and a half long, ex parte, with this radiologist who only read an MRI report. On the rebuttal issue, I consider this one to be a real showstopper for us. Dr. Washer testified that he is highly trained in reading his own MRIs. He's an expert. We established that foundation. There was, in fact, no objection to his qualifications on that score from the defense. This was a case where the court was faced with losing two half days of time, half of one afternoon and half of the next morning before my rebuttal expert could testify. It was an enormous amount of pressure to limit his testimony. In fact, at one point the judge said I was going to get six words out of this person, and that was it. And he struck, Dr. Washer's rebuttal to the radiologist was, you cannot diagnose infection from an MRI. You can see there's fluid, but you don't know what that fluid is. And in this case, the radiologist said, that is not suspicious for infection, that fluid. That's not infection. And The defendant's position seems to be that I can only rebut Dr. Davis's testimony, but the rebuttal can rebut his case. And Dr. Cernkovich was the key witness that they met with ex parte four times, and that's the heart of his testimony. There's no infection on that MRI, so it's okay for the doctor to inject the shoulder. So my rebuttal is no, you can't say that from that. It went to the core of the case. It was short rebuttal, and the basis for striking it was simply that Dr. Washer wasn't qualified. But then when I tried to offer his, and I actually put it into evidence, his deposition transcript where he talked about his training in MRIs, the trial court refused to look at it. So I think that the manifestly arbitrary and unfair standard is met on that issue, and that issue really affected the outcome of the trial in this case.
How can it be manifestly arbitrary in light of the Hall case?
What part of the Hall case?
Doesn't Hall, and aren't there other cases that say that you have to be, you actually have to be a specialist in that particular field?
That's under the Healthcare Availability Act, Title 1364, I think it's 101. And what that's talking about is in a medical malpractice case, the physician testifying as to the standard of care has to be of the same subspecialty or training as the defendant. And there's actually a number of cases. There's the Hall case. I can't remember the other one if it's Green. But essentially, you can have an internal medicine doctor testify against a physician's assistant if they're both trained and have experience in doing exactly what the issue is in the case.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up.
All right. Thanks, Ron.
If it pleases the court, my name is Brian McConaughey. Registration number 7280 on behalf of the defendant appellant. If I may first address the Dr. Cernkovich meetings, please. Attorneys are called to zealously represent their clients and to conduct interviews when appropriate. I gave Sam's notice on a number of doctors. Sam's notice was not appropriate with regard to Dr. Cernkovich. So we went and met with several doctors after I'd given Sam's notice. I wasn't required to invite him along with Dr. Cernkovich because there was no attorney or physician-patient privilege.
How do we know that?
It's never been raised. I think it's a matter of proof. What happens is if physician-patient privilege, it's up to the plaintiff to prove that it applies. In this case, they never proved it. All they proved was that the doctor was in consultation, and Dr. Cernkovich testified he was in consultation. On page 4, right before Dr. Cernkovich's testimony, Mr. Tyler said he clearly was in consultation. Those are quotes from the record. Can I give you the page number on that, Your Honor?
It's up to you.
Mr. Tyler said on page 4 of the compact disc on 1908, he was clearly in consultation with Dr. Davis. He sent Dr. Davis the report. Dr. Davis looked at it. Dr. Davis testified that he relied on that report. And then Dr. Cernkovich testified at page 70 of the same day, 1908. Technically, she's not a patient of mine. She was referred. I was a consultant on the case, so I don't know what the legal distinction is, etc.
So there was never a disputed issue that there was consultation in this case.
And it was undisputed. So if it's undisputed that they're in consultation, 1390.107 says there is no physician-patient privilege. And the burden is on the plaintiff to show that there is. And they didn't show that. And therefore, Judge McCrum did not abuse his discretion. And if you to get, Dr. Cernkovich never met, examined, or even saw this patient. In fact, the MRI was taken at one building, and Dr. Cernkovich was at another when he interpreted the MRI. So he didn't have any communication with her. And Reuter says where there's a high risk of residually, remnantly privileged information, then we should give notice. Here, there was no risk, and that proved out to be the testimony. The second thing that was brought up was Dr. Noonan and kind of the creation of the list. CRCP Rule 26A2 talks about really two classes of experts. The first class of expert is the retained expert. And the idea is you kind of keep track, you keep a ball score on them. Whereas treating physicians, which is the second category, you don't, and it's not required. And CRCP 26A2, even in the comments, make clear that there's a distinction between those two categories.
But given what you say, here Dr. Noonan was a specially retained expert.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what is there in the rule that leads you to believe that he didn't have to disclose his prior testimony whenever he'd been an expert in the last 4 years, whether he was specially retained or not? Because it talks about you have to disclose prior testimony when you testified as an expert. He said, I testified as an expert. Now, I did so as a treating physician, but I testify as an expert. Why doesn't the plain language of the rule say that the list should have been disclosed here?
Well, I think the plain language of the rule says that you plainly distinguish between those two, and that they understand that they're both experts. They're experts whether they're retained or non-retained. They're still testifying as an expert.
That kind of gets to the heart of the question, because when you say whether he's retained or a treating physician, that directs you as to whether you look at B1 or B2. But assuming that there's no argument that we're looking at B1, when it says what the witness has to provide, it says other cases in which the witness has testified as an expert, but it doesn't say as a specially retained expert.
No, and I, you know, the practice in the bar is that physicians do not keep their treating testimony. And I think that is anticipated in the rule. If you look at 26A2B1, with respect to a witness who is retained or specially employed to provide expert testimony, and then you skip through there about right toward the end of that same paragraph, a listing of any other cases in which the witness has testified as an expert at trial, and other cases meaning when they've testified as a retained expert.
Do you have any case anywhere that says that?
No, that's the practice in the bar. And I guess a little bit of background
maybe,
here.
Maybe the bar has it wrong.
I'd hate to think so. But you're right.
What we've got to deal with is language here and cases that may have interpreted it.
Well, I think by way of background, you say, okay, so this deposition of Dr. Noonan occurred in April. And that's Exhibit G on the record on the and in that deposition, I said at page 42, first of all, Dr. Noonan says, I don't keep a list. And then I said, listen, he's not required to keep a list since he's never testified as a retained expert. This was his first case. But if you want one, you know, let me know. And we'll have, if you ask for it, we'll give it to you. You'll have to pay for his assistant to put it together, but we're not going to withhold it from you if you want. He never asked for it in formal discovery ever. Even after this, he didn't ask for an informal discovery. So I'm not obligated to incur the cost to create a list that's not required when he's not asking for it. He didn't ask for it in the request for production, an interrogatory, his motion to compel, or even informal letter. So, you know, on the facts of this case, I think Judge McCrum just thought, okay, let's try to balance the equities here. First of all, this guy is a first-time testifier. He's not required to keep a list. He doesn't keep a list. And McConaughey has said, we'll create one for you if you ask, but you're going to have to pay for it, just for his clerk to put it together. No ask, nothing. Just at trial, the next time it comes up after April is in trial in January with a motion to strike the witness.
Do they have to ask for it? Aren't Rule 26 expert disclosures self-executing?
As to retained experts, when they've testified in prior where they've been retained previously, yes. But not when they've not been retained. When there's no obligation, if you look, there's absolutely no requirement under subsection 2 that they keep a list. And then the comment says that's for very good reason, because we distinguish between testimonial, you know, these retained experts, and the treating physicians. It talks about it in the commentary. And I think that that's exactly the distinction that's being drawn in this case. I just, with regard to the comment, I refused to produce it. I didn't refuse to produce it. It didn't exist. And I said we'd dig for it if asked, and we were never asked. With regard to Dr. Washer and the rebuttal evidence, first of all, Dr. Washer was permitted to testify. He was permitted. They said you bring him up live if you want. He can testify by phone if you want, or he can testify by stipulation. And he did. He testified at Mr. Tyler's choice. He testified by stipulation. And the stipulation talked about the abnormal MRI.
this is at page 39 in
uh, 110, 08,
where he testifies that the abnormal MRI was a large effusion extension of fluid into the subacromial space with a lack of clear etiology that should have led Dr. Davis to suspect and rule out infection as well as other inflammatory conditions. So they got all they wanted about MRI. What they were asking to do was to have Dr. Washer come up or testify by stipulation or by phone that Dr. Cernkovich had it wrong. And I think what Judge McCrum thought was, you know, this, number one, it's cumulative. We've already heard this from Dr. Cleary. But with regard to whether Dr. Cernkovich has it wrong, that is a 403 kind of discussion. You go, how would that be relevant and not prejudicial to the defendant? Doctor, by way of background, and the testimony was that Dr. Davis does not read his own MRIs. It wasn't in his training, so he doesn't do it. So he has to rely on the radiologist. Basically, what Dr. Washer was going to say is, you shouldn't have relied on the radiologist because we've got somebody who disputes the way he read the film and reported on it. So I think that's why Judge McCrum said that, you know, this is cumulative, it's improper rebuttal. And I think it was. If it pleases the court, those were my comments. Yeah, and I'd certainly like to have any questions if you have any.
Can I go back to the Trattler issue for
please.
A minute? Let's assume that you're wrong, as a matter of law, that you did have an obligation under the rule to disclose the prior depositions that Noonan gave as a treating physician. What's your position on what happens next? We're up here on appeal now. The trial's over with. The court obviously didn't strike his testimony. But, I mean, what do we do with that?
Well, I think the court is going to have to figure out, because that's not the practice in the bar. So then how many cases is that going to affect? How many times are we going to get plaintiffs now saying this, or defense saying that this wasn't disclosed and therefore there's some sort of reversible error in there?
I'm just talking about this case. Is that automatic reversal, or are there other things that we look at? What do we do with that if that's where we were to come out?
I think what you'd say, first of all, is let me get other my thoughts for a second. If it's error as a matter of law, then almost every case that we have in which there are physician experts is going to be reversed. And I think the plaintiff did not perfect their ability to raise this issue at this point. Let's just assume it's a debatable issue, which we don't think it is. But let's just assume it's debatable. The way to debate it is bring it up by a motion with the court, bring it up by some sort of formal request to perfect it with the defense, raise it some way so that the judge can address it other than just by being asked to strike a witness in the middle of trial for the first time that issue's ever been raised.
Yeah, I like the second issue. The court did not specifically refuse to find that it was untimely. If the first issue is a in contrast to the second issue.
Yes, we said that. We said this is the first time, and I think he just gave the plaintiffs the benefit of the doubt. He said, well, he raised it earlier in the trial. It was raised at a couple places during the trial transcript. So the judge just gave him the benefit of the doubt by saying, well, I'm not going to find that it's untimely. I'm going to address the issue. And then he did address the issue, and I think correctly. And I think according to the practice that we're doing, it was accurate.
So I guess I'm just having a hard time following your earlier comments about how they should have filed a motion to compel, or they should have done some other pretrial procedure. If the court entertained the legal issue without finding that they were procedurally barred, where does that leave us as an appellate court?
Well, I think the judge was just being a good guy. He just said, I'm not going to bar you on the technical ground. I'm going to address the issue, and I'm going to address it fairly. And he did. And you go, right. And that is the practice that's out there. That is the way things are addressed. The retained versus the treating expert is clearly differentiated. Could have been clearer, frankly, but in 26A2. And that's the way law is being practiced out there. And if he wants to create new law, I think you have to kind of say, okay, let's perfect this so that when it gets to the Court of Appeals, we can at least have a meaningful argument about it, as opposed to saying strike the witness in the middle of trial, you know, for the first time in 10 months since the issue has been joined in deposition.
Is all the argument at trial oral? I take it there weren't any briefs on this issue.
Correct. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments. The matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Counsel on the Durham case are excused, and if counsel on the Waldman case want to set up a counsel table, we'll hear that matter next.